My name is Morgan Pierce. I'm a baritone and I'm singing the role of Aquila in the English Concerts production, recording and concert tour of Handel's Giulio Cesare. We're in a gorgeous church up here in East Finchley in preparation of our final performance here in London on Sunday at the Barbican.
A horn is like a big dog and it has to know who's boss. If the horn thinks it's boss, then everything goes wrong. The baroque horn came from the hunting horn, and then it's slightly polished version of that, but really not very much. So a slightly polished version of the hunting horn that's sort of been allowed indoors. My name is Ursula, and I play the horn. The main thing that you get from playing on a period instrument is that we have a lot more colours to play with. That's kind of the whole point of a modern horn, is that it sounds the same in the whole range.
I think a lot of Baroque composers have written for the voice in a much more instrumental kind of way. This off-the-voice straight tone thing, which is used mainly as a colour in Baroque music to give you this, like, as opposed to so the lack of vibrato in the sound is something that's used in Baroque music for colour. And the way that an instrumentalist might bow an instrument, one of the string instruments might play a note, it sort of lines up pretty similarly to that kind of style of producing sound.
I'm Joseph Crouch, and I'm the first cellist of the English Concert. This G string, you can hear that sound, that chiff you're hearing at the beginning of the note. It's, I would think of that as the equivalent of the consonant at the beginning of a syllable. And the Baroque cello and the Baroque bow in particular are very good at eliciting the sound, the articulations of speech.
The colours you get when you play an early horn just gives you so much ease to manoeuvre around the phrases, and you are so much more agile that you can play those light steps that you need when you play Baroque music. What I just played now is one of the ways you can play really soft and sort of gentle on the Baroque horn, which is one of the things I really love in the way you can manipulate the Baroque horn to be a sort of loving sound, and then it can easily change character.
And because of the lighter orchestration in Baroque music, it lends itself to those kind of extra sort of technical tricks that you use to express what you're saying. Versus.
My horn doesn't have any valves. The Baroque horn is the instrument that Handel would have known, essentially. It's a very basic instrument. It's just a bit of tubing with a bell at the end. And that's it.
This cello has three strings made just with wound sheep gut. It's very much like holding a baby on one's lap. It's the instrument only weighs about, I'm not sure, 4 or 5 kilos. So it's not heavy to carry.
One of the real benefits of Baroque music is that because the musical forces are smaller, you get to play a lot more with colour. And so you'll hear in Baroque singing, there's a lot more affect, so people use a lot more colour in the voice, particularly in recit. And so that variety can be really exciting and sort of a unique feel that you get in Baroque music.
For me, the big thing that these instruments can really do is that they can speak. With speaking, that's what you do with your lips and your teeth and your tongue. And all of those things have a direct equivalence in the way I play the cello.
The way we produce the notes and we hear the notes, we have to hear every note before they come out, and that's very similar to singing. And a lot of brass players will also have loads of singing lessons. There's so much overlap in technique. I also come from a background of singing.
I very rarely have to play a note that's that long, and what I'm really concerned with is the sounds between the notes. The sounds between the notes are the consonants. The notes, to me, are the vowels. You need consonants in order to impart meaning, and without meaning you can't impart emotion.
I quite often send my college students to have singing lessons if there's something that doesn't work in their technique, because it's usually the way to fix it. I'm always extremely aware of the text. When we play operas, the text of what we do and the rhetoric of the text is always extremely important. We have to know what we're trying to say. Just as we have to work when we speak the Baroque language, we have to know what are we working with in the hierarchy of the bar, and where are we going with the phrase, what are we doing.
The music that I play has to function not just like a language in that it's capable of imparting emotion, but in a way that's absolutely analogous to language, that is grammatical, and that the best way of making it appear to have a grammar is to make the way that my notes fit together appear like the way that you fit syllables together into words, and words into phrases, and phrases into sentences, and sentences into paragraphs, and paragraphs into stories.
There's a lot of scholarship and, you know, several, you know, thousands of PhDs based around what real, you know, Baroque style is.
Keeping on top of new research and doing our own research and trying to be informed as best as I can, both for myself and for the orchestra, to make sure that I'm an informed colleague.
There's a tension between the things that we read, the traditional research, and the practice research. There's often a direct contradiction between the things that you read and the things that you do. This language that we're speaking, this language of Handel in England, it evolves the more we play it. It becomes more and more our individual dialect or our orchestra's way of speaking. The more fluent we become in our interpretation of this written language, in the way that we want to speak it, the easier we find it to carry emotional content to the audience. That is all informed by the way that we trained and the books that we read and the techniques that we learned. But even more so, it is the result of us playing together, touring together, recording together.
We have to, you know, delve into the scholarship and understand what kind of sound Handel wanted. And it's not that there's a bad or a good way of doing things. There's an informed way. And I always like to think that, you know, were Handel or Bach alive today and they were sitting listening to music, they'd probably love that we had a different way of doing something, because composers always push the boundaries. The best composers always push the boundaries of what they had available to them. And certainly Handel was no exception to that.
We are consciously, constantly thinking about these questions, how to use the knowledge that we've brought, much of which we constantly forget we have, but how to use that knowledge to further our quest of enlivening the text that we're performing, of making it into a conversation with each other and the audience.
The collaboration with my colleagues is incredibly important, and a lot of it happens before we meet in the rehearsals. That includes the research, so emails to Harry and emails between colleagues and all of that. That happens before.
You know, we're forever quoting sources at each other to back up an argument that we have. And at any point, someone with enough basic knowledge of any of these sources can easily counteract them with another argument. Should we start on an up bow or a down bow? Well, this source says this. Yeah, but this, but yeah, he only wrote this because of this.
One of the emails that happened leading up to this project led to something very special. And at the time it arrived, I was quite annoyed. To be, to my shame, very, very annoyed. And from Tom, our harpsichord player. And he said, you know, bar 26, this note, it has really irked me every time I've heard this opera, because it creates this parallel with the bass line. And I was like, oh, really? Really? You think that, not just me, but everyone for the past 150 years have been playing the wrong note. So I went to the British Library. So I looked at the microfilm. It's like a roll of film, and then you look at this massive computer screen. It makes you feel really old-fashioned, and it's very satisfying. And unfortunately, Tom was right. Handel's writing was incredibly clear. In the Handel revival, a man, musicologist called Chrysander, did a new edition of all the Handel works. And the 1875 was the Giulio Cesare version. And he did the mistake. He did a misprint in that one semiquaver in bar 26. And all parts have been copied from his parts ever since.
That collection of 20 different people with 20 different moods who've had 20 different kinds of mourning and 20 different journeys to work and all of the interactions that happen, you know, up to that moment and in that moment as a collective of people and as a bunch of individuals is the thing that keeps it alive for all of us.
And that's great because it shows development over time. I listen to loads of recordings. I love reading things, and I get immense pleasure just listening to people.
When you have a live performance for video, the thing that I'm always looking for is something in the body language or the facial expression of a musician, singer, that helps communicate something about the texture of the score.
I tend to think that if something's going to be videoed, it's almost like a bonus audience, but realistically, for me, I try and avoid the camera as much as possible and perform exactly the same as I would if there were no camera there.
It's easy for the camera person to find that solo voice with the lens and to focus on that solo voice. But finding a way to show the relationship between that solo voice and one or several of the other voices in the texture. That's where the person manning the camera can really help the viewer understand what's going on in the score.
I think the video will ultimately capture the live performance, and it's down to the videographer to make sure that capturing process is as close to possible as being in the room were someone to buy a ticket.
There's a load in at 6:30 this morning, and the goods lift unfortunately is out of action, so we had to come in via a different route. But yeah, all the kit came in, and then I've been into the roof to rig the slung mics that come down from the roof. I'm Jonathan Stokes, and I'm making the audio recording which is accompanying the video for this concert in the Barbican of Handel Julius Caesar. Quite a big show, long show, starts at 6, I think, isn't going to be finished till 10. I think there are a few intervals. I'm in what they call room 304, which is with the sound studio, which is backstage, hidden away, in a pretty dark and dingy room, to be honest with you. No windows, but I do have a big screen which I can see everything that happens on stage.
Hi, my name is Will Gray, and I am here in the Barbican with the English Concert. I'm going to be filming them. I'm the DOP for the project. It's a bit of a puzzle, really, trying to fit it all together. What is the core thing that this composer, because Handel, is trying to get across?
There's about 35 mics out. There's a pair of microphones in the audience to pick up a bit of atmosphere and also audience participation if and when they applaud and whatever. We've then got a rig of mics hanging from the roof across the front of the orchestra. That gives the main core sound across the orchestra. Then we've got mics on each of the soloists. And then we've got one on the first violin section, just to give a little bit of bite to that. One on the rest of the other string sections. One on the keyboards. Then there's a theorbo, the continuo. All of those instruments need to be individually mic'd, because in the recit passages, it's quite important that you can hear the accompaniment, what's going on.
You can get a bit of height and get a kind of nice wide shot, which kind of takes the whole space, captures the whole space of the room. We'll have, again, a kind of sideways shot on stage looking across the winds at the back. And I think we'll have another one looking for the cello as well. Yeah, we've got a couple of the cameras kind of looking at the stage to get the duets and the singles. It's making sure you've got that kind of like head-on hero shot, you know. You want it to be kind of from waist up, close enough that you can see what they're doing and not distracted by anything else.
It's a constant mix process throughout the whole show. I've got a big video monitor where I'm working in front of me, so I can sort of track where they move. And those 35 mics come up on a like a virtual mixer on the computer, and I can adjust the level of that. I can add a little bit of reverb to any individual mic if I want to.
I've got headsets on, which means that there's someone reading the score as it goes. So listening to the score, reading it, and has marked up, you know, what's happening at certain times. You're listening to it, and then you're trying to communicate as much as you can in whispered, you know, I've got this one, who's got the violin, anybody got the flute, you know, that kind of thing.
If for whatever reason one of the singers moves and I don't quite track it correctly and it's not quite so in focus, after the event I can go back and remix that so that it covers it in a much better way. There is a rehearsal this afternoon which we will be taking little bits from. It clearly won't be the whole show though. But in addition to that, if for whatever reason something did fall over on stage and there's a bit of a clatter, there's quite sophisticated software now that can be used in order to sort of paintbrush those things out or certainly minimise them.
We've got this very very fun looking contraption on the stage, which is called a skate plate, and it's basically a track where we can kind of walk along, gives you a bit of ability to add some movement to the shots if needed.
The ideal version of good audio is something that actually reflects what is actually happening in the hall, in the venue itself. You want a bit of perspective. You don't want a dead flat audio stage. You need a little bit of depth to it to feel as if you're actually in the Barbican.
You do want to set the scene. You do want to get the space, the kind of, because it is amazing. It's a massive hall. You want the kind of audience to be able to understand that and to feel like they're there. Making sure you get the combination of both the space and the intricacy, I think, is something magical, which provides a different experience than if you were in the hall, but can be actually very, very enjoyable.
It's fantastic music. Something like this doesn't get performed that often. So when the chance comes up to actually record it, you grab it. You know, you just ride on that through the whole programme. But when I just finesse a few things after the event, that's when the enjoyment comes, and then I just hand the final product over. That's when the final enjoyment comes.
We all have our own little focuses, and that is such an easy thing to be really selfish about.
My message to the person in the editing suite is don't please come at this editing process just thinking about who looks best when they're playing.
I would hope that at least during Vatachito I was somewhere in there. If the editor wants to just be elsewhere, I'm totally happy with that.
We're not there to look good when we play any more than we are actually in the end to impress people with the beauty of our sound. We're there to share communication. So what matters is, what is that person communicating? Sometimes stillness can be super powerful too.
I trust them to do a good job. It's not my job. I've done my job. Now it's in their hands.
Then I need to make them into a multi-camera, get the time code syncing up. I was DOP, Director of Photography, at the show when we performed it live, and so I'm now sitting in the edit suite, which is in the English Concert kind of main building, and I'm upstairs and it's dark to make sure I can see my colours and my screen properly. When I'm pressing play like this, I have part of my screen shows all the cameras running at the same time, so I can see what's going on in all 8-9 cameras that we have. And what we're looking for is to find the things that are going to be of most interest to the viewer. So we're going to start probably you want to start and set the scene on the one kind of wider shots. And then as the performance goes on and as the drama unfolds, you know, you want to get closer, you want to see the details, and how can I create visual interest, or how can I create movement? There might be cutaways to different parts in the orchestra, so just making sure I'm picking up on both what the orchestra are doing and also what the singers are doing. I'll go through and I'll do a first pass of just as if I was there live. I'm making decisions, I'm seeing what's happening, and I'm just cutting between the numbers, kind of using my keyboard to cut. And so that means that I've got a rough edit, something that works, and I felt emotionally was right. I'm making sure I'm letting a singer complete their kind of phrase and still see them whilst the next musical phrase is happening. You can also see the interplay sometimes between the musicians. So I can see the singers, obviously, but I can also see the cellist just kind of leaning in and looking towards the violin, or kind of like, you know, getting ready to play their bit. And so you see visually as well some of those lines that might be hidden if you were just looking at the singer. So I get to kind of see that and make a call. And do that section by section by section all the way through. Which can be, you know, it's about, this one I think was just shy of 4 hours, you know, 3 hours, 45 minutes or something. So a lot of five minute chunks. But it takes a lot of time, because it's also obviously I watched that 5 minute chunk at least 3 times live in kind of real time, plus all the little edit bits that I do. So it's like you're looking at 3-4 times the length of the piece that I'm there doing edits. A final piece, a kind of a memory of the performance, It feels like a big responsibility to kind of to recreate that experience for someone else that is going to last for a long time.
A recording stands sort of stationary in time, and it gives us a snapshot of what, you know, in 2025 we thought about, you know, Julius Caesar and what these artists thought about this piece of music.
He told this story about listening to Bach suites with my Walkman as a 9-year-old. And it's still such a joy to do that. I still have it on my phone and listen to it on my train journeys.
I love the thought that the recording that we're doing now might, in decades to come, be used as a snapshot of how we did it right now.
Even though we're dealing with pieces that are hundreds of years old, we can find new things now, and in 50 years' time, people will continue to find new things with them and perform them differently.
In the future, I'd love the idea that someone looks back and says, yeah, in 2025, there was this bunch of musicians who got together and did it like this, and isn't that interesting?